Hello and welcome back. It's great to have all of you with us again. Sister Denise has been sharing her churnings and her understanding of the Bhagavad Gita in this series entitled The Gita Decoded. We are on chapter 7, which is entitled The Yoga of the Knowledge of Discrimination. And Sister Denise is taking us through this chapter to share what the real message is that God is delivering to his children. Sister Denise, it's great to have you here back again.
Thank you.
We stopped at the end of the last episode on verse 8, and the praise of God continues in verse 9. I'd like to begin in verse 10, which reads, "Know me to be the primeval seed of all creatures, Arjuna." I find that expression rather curious, primeval seed. Could you explain what that means? A seed of what?
Primeval means the originating. So you have this idea of God as everything and everyone, and also as the primogenitor. So God causes everything to be, and everything that is part of God's body, as it were. And this is really this concept of omnipresence that is very, very common. If you look at the third line of this stanza, "I am the intelligence of the intelligent," is actually different from the other lines. And it is said for God, "I am the intelligence of the wise." You can say a person is wise because they have studied with God and they have absorbed his intelligence, his wisdom into themselves, which has made them sparkle. So the way I interpret the influence of God on everything is that God is an energy, a source of qualities which gives the sparkle to everything. Any one of us may be endowed with virtues and so on. And very often people say these are gifts. The nature of the relationship with God is that you ascribe any good, pure, or divine qualities that are in you, you say these are gifts from God because you want to acknowledge that the ultimate source of all of this is God. Because if you say it's me, you're edging God out, E-G-O, ego. So these are devices.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Ego, edging God out. Okay, it'll take me a while to get over that, but continue.
So anyway, if you say, okay, I am full of all these marvelous qualities and so on and so forth, so therefore you should, you know, praise me and worship me and whatnot. Now that is not the right way to be. So a way to keep oneself humble and to, you know, make sure that you never try to displace God or edge God out, to always say, okay, whatever there is in me that is godlike and splendid and so on, it's a gift from God and I am therefore a trustee of it. And it has to be used, not how I want, but according to the directions of God. Whatever are the brilliance and qualities and specialities, especially of people, of nature, you know, their creation, so they reflect the glory of the Creator. It's correct to say, there but for the grace of God go I, kind of thing. You see what I'm saying?
I'm going to read verse 12, 13, and 14 because they flow into each other. I notice that the three gunas makes a return in this chapter. And it reads as follows, "And those states of being which are sattvic, and those which are rajasic and tamasic, know that they proceed from me, but I am not in them, they are in me." How do you understand this?
The way we understand this in Brahma Kumaris is a little bit different from the conventional way. What we would say is the Creator is God, who has the full knowledge of himself, the Creator, and the creation. So the nature of the creation is it proceeds from a completely pure state, sattvic, through the middle level, rajasic, to the impure state, tamasic. And then God, the purifier, takes the impure creation and purifies it again. So in that sense, yes, it proceeds from him. He knows about it. He knows how it goes. And because he knows them, you would say they are in him, not physically in him, but they're known to him.
This then takes us to verse 13. All this universe is deluded by these three states of being, composed of the qualities. It does not recognize me. Who am I higher than these and eternal? And verse 14, divine indeed is this illusion of mine, made up of the three qualities and difficult to penetrate. Only those who resort to me transcend this illusion.
You see, again, we have an interpretation of the word Maya as illusion. But you could interpret it in another way. And people talk about God's Maya, God's illusion, or you also hear the Lila, the game of God. But the way we look at it in Brahma Kumaris, what we have been taught, is the nature of the creation is like this. It is initially absolutely pure, and then as time goes by, as the machinery of souls and matter play out, they become more and more worn out, old, tamopradhan. And so this we do not consider matter as Maya, you see, but in many philosophers say matter is Maya, going back to that expression, Brahma Satya Jagat Mitya. So Brahma Satya means that which is non-material is true. God is also non-material. God is true. God is unchanging. And then Jagat, Jagat means the world, the creation, Mitya. So it's an illusion. It's not real. It is real, but it keeps changing. And it's because of the changes that it is described as illusory, but it doesn't mean that it's not real.
So something can be illusory and still real?
It's not illusory, it's impermanent. So impermanent doesn't mean illusory, but it has been described as meaning that because of this phrase, Brahma Satya Jagat Mitya. And then also because of these other descriptions that you have in 13, you see, all this universe is deluded by these three states of being. So there's a lot of contention as to what is the meaning of Sato, Rajo, and Tamo. And what I find is that the way these three gunas are described in the teachings that are studied by the Brahma Kumaris is very clear. The creator knows the creation and knows how it goes from a state of perfection to a state of imperfection, and the variation in the states is the states of being, which is the perfected state, sattva, truth, the middle level, rajas, which is connected with this passion and all, and then the completely impure gross state. So it's going from a very sublime, very pure state, very refined state, rather the way of entropy.
Mr. Denise, the last two lines of verse 14 captured my attention. Only those who resort to me transcend this illusion. In light of what you just said, how does the correct understanding of verse 13 and 14 impact on one's relationship with God?
The word illusion is the translation of Maya, and Maya isn't necessarily illusion only.
Okay.
In this case, Maya refers to the world, and God is the knower of the world. For example, a scientist knows the world through observation, through the scientific method. God would say, well, that's very fine, but it doesn't show you everything. So if you know me and the world through me, then you'll really know it. So if you resort to him, that is to say you listen to him, okay, God, tell us who you are and tell us about your creation, because a human being cannot arrive at an understanding of God by looking at the material world. They will arrive at conclusions which are based on sense perception. And although science is said to be objective, any person who does a scientific experimentation and observes the result is observing it through their senses. And then what the science also has been dealing with is the observer effect, which is that the experiment will vary according to what the experimenter wants or expects. So that became very difficult to figure out. What does this mean? It means essentially that matter is altered by consciousness. And then with God as the highest form of consciousness, then the way in which God looks at, thinks about, and interacts with the creation, that's the way the creation becomes. This is how he changes the creation. By God telling us, okay, this is me, this is who I am, and this is what the creation is, then you can know it, but you can't know it any other way, which is why this is called revealed knowledge, as opposed to knowledge derived through observation.
Let us now go to verse 16. Among benevolent men, four kinds worship me, Arjuna: the distressed, those who desire wealth, those who desire knowledge, and the men of wisdom, Arjuna. What is your understanding of this, and why does God call these type of men benevolent?
Well, I'm just looking at the Sanskrit word for benevolent. Sukritinas, okay? So kriti is action. So sukritinas means people who are concerned about performing right action. So by extension, benevolent, you can say. But this is the difficulty with translation. You kind of get off in the interpretation of the translator. But fortunately, he's given us all the Sanskrit and a dictionary as well. But what I would say is, you know, people who are interested in God, people who are interested in spirituality, they are people who are concerned about right action. So out of all the possible people who are concerned about right action, there are distressed people. They're concerned about right action because things are going wrong. They want to know how to make it go right. So they're concerned. Those who desire wealth. Well, if you do certain karma, you will get rich. If you do certain other karma, you will get nothing, or you will lose everything. So they want to know the spiritual knowledge because they want money. The distressed people want to know spiritual knowledge because they don't want to be distressed. They want some peace. There are people who desire knowledge because they want to control things. Knowledge is power, that kind of thing. And then you see the man of wisdom, the one who wants to understand because he wants to be right, not because he wants to get anything. This is God's view of the different kinds of people that there are. You know, it's very clear in the Gita and in the Hindu philosophies that people are not equal. In Western philosophy, you have this principle of equality, which was basically enunciated by John Locke. But here, no. People are motivated very differently. People have different capacities. And there is a pyramid. There's a hierarchy. And the question is, where do you fit? Are you a man of wisdom, coming to God as a man of wisdom, or are you distressed? You know, definitely there's going to be a different quality of relationship depending on what your condition is and what you want. You know, in the Mahabharata, you see the Kauravas who want the powers of God, and the Pandavas, they want God on their side in the war. You can see right there that the ones who win the ones who achieve the highest state are the ones who love God for his own sake, not for what they can get from him.
That last answer of yours takes us to verse 17, which says just that. Of them, the man of wisdom, eternally steadfast, devoted to the one alone, capital O, is preeminent. I am indeed exceedingly fond of the man of wisdom, and he is fond of me.
So there it is, love beats everything.
But we're talking divine love, not ordinary love.
Your love for God, God love for you, that's it. You've arrived.
That's a very interesting question to ask oneself, Denise. It's not that you love God, but what is behind your love for God? I think very few people question their love for God. You get born into a religion and you follow that religion and you communicate to God in your own way, but very few of us stop and take the time to ask, what is it that brings me here? What do I want from God?
Well,
and why?
What do you want from God? And then there's, do you just want God? Without wanting anything else, you just want God. That's the highest. And what is within God? Truth, wisdom. That's the thing that's desirable. And this is what he describes as the preeminent one, is the one who loves God because God is the most lovable being there is, because of what's contained in God, because of what God does.
What is contained in God that makes him lovable?
The angle that God has on himself and on the creation, I think, is what ensures that God remains in a state of bliss. And you want to be with God in a state of bliss too, because you want to be near to God. God is the source, God is the ocean of all the qualities. Everything that makes life meaningful is contained within God. God's properties he will offer you, but you know, having somebody's property is one thing. You know, do you marry somebody for their money or for them? It's a similar question.
Verse 19, Sister Denise. At the end of many births, the man of wisdom resorts to me, thinking Vasudeva, in brackets Krishna, in my translation, is all. Such a great soul is hard to find. Those words, at the end of many births, the man of wisdom resorts to me. That is noteworthy, isn't it?
There is something that we speak about within the Brahma Kumaris, that the person who has passed through the full cycle of 84 births and has reached the end of the last of his many births is the one who God will work with to effect the regeneration of the world. And this then is how we see Prajapita Brahma, you see. So this is very interesting, you know, because I spoke before of this idea, Brahma becomes Vishnu, Vishnu becomes Brahma, and you see that in certain images in different temples. God is perfect, and his first creation is perfect. So as it says in the Sikh scripture, it doesn't take God very long to transform a human being into a deity. So God will take the number one human soul who is at the end of the last of his many, many births, teach him and make him into what he was originally, which is similar to himself, which corresponds to the idea in the Christian Bible, where it says, you know, God makes man in his own image, but he only made Adam that, and then everybody else came later. So the idea, again, the hierarchy of people, who is the number one human being? So among all the gods and goddesses, okay, it is said Krishna. And here you have Krishna, the speaker of the Gita. And what we are also seeing is there's God, who is the knower of all things. And then there's Krishna, who is the product of the knower of all things as the person with a human body. Because you always see Krishna with a body, he's got Radha, he becomes Narayan, he is the true man, you see. So you have Krishna the man, and then you have God, the most attractive one, which is also with the epithet Krishna. So this becomes quite complex to unravel, but I do see that this verse also gives us a clue as to what's happening here, how God works with that soul who is so hard to find, a great soul who is really the man of wisdom, the one who loves God for his own sake. That is Arjuna, you see. As you saw from the beginning of the war, Arjuna said, Krishna, I just want you. And Krishna says, well, I'm not going to give you anything that I have. I'm just going to be there with you. And then Duryodhana wants, Dhritarashtra wants the powers of God. If you look historically, the people who tried to conquer the world, Alexander, Hitler, whoever, they want military and political dominion over others, you see, and it never works.
They want it to be godlike.
They want to replace God, displace God. So that's the ego edging God out again, you see. Mm. Whereas the one who only wants God, God will give him everything. Mm. Because he doesn't want to take everything. He just wants the one who has everything. So a very interesting, you know, focus. What do you want? Do you want something that's going to be a big status symbol? Or do you want the one who is the most beautiful, the most wise, the most extraordinary to be with?
Yeah. That's mind-blowing, Denise. It is mind-blowing. Okay, so here we are at verse 20. Men whose knowledge has been carried away by these and those desires resort to other gods, small g, lowercase. Okay? Having recourse to this and that religious rite, constrained by their own material natures, whoever desires to honor with belief whatever worshipped form, on him I bestow immovable faith. What I find so touching about that is that God acknowledges the various practices that people engage in to acknowledge God. And God says, I give the return. So no single thought, no single act, no single word towards God goes unnoticed by the Supreme Soul. That is amazing. So many people feel God does not know me, God does not answer my prayers, God does not know I'm alive. And it's an awful feeling being alone in this universe without the parent soul. It's an awful feeling.
Yeah, but it's doubt, isn't it?
Yes, but you see, they're looking for proof. Okay, let's come back to this stanza. How do you interpret it?
Well, this is again referring to people who want stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you can't get your desires fulfilled, you will find various rituals, like it says, having recourse to this and that religious rite, you will do various things in order to get something. You remember when we were talking about the castes? Mm. The merchant caste is the one who say, well, I'll do this and then you give me that. It's really merchant caste type here. And it says at the end, you know, constrained by their own material nature. So you can say they're absolutely motivated by materialism. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they're still his children. And so he will give them a reward. And whoever addresses God on any level will get, I mean, God is reciprocal. Mm. This is the very interesting thing.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Tell us more about that, because this is Denise, very few people know that, and that's got to do with your self-respect.
God doesn't really like people going to him begging. because he will say, look, you're my child, you should know it. If you have a real faith in yourself that I am a child of God, God is looking after me, you're not going to be looking for proof and signs. You're going to have faith. It is there. This is a much higher quality person.
I'm going to read verses 22 and 23 together because they flow into each other. He who endowed with this faith desires to propitiate that form, receives from it his desires, because those desires are decreed by me, capital M. But temporary is that fruit for those of small understanding. To the gods, the God worshippers go, both small g, okay, lowercase g, my worshippers surely come to me. Whatever desires exist in souls who worship God, go to God for anything, he fulfills it.
God is incorporeal. The vast majority of devotees need something more physical to go to, so they go to the gods with small g, the different divinities, deities. Hinduism is pantheistic. There's lots and lots of gods and goddesses. And the incorporeal God is inaccessible, inconceivable. If a person has what's known as a tamopradan intellect, they're unable to conceptualize something or someone that is not tangible. Those who want to know God, who love God as God, they will come to God. But they're a minority.
Okay, Sister Denise, unfortunately we have to stop right there. So there you go. Sister Denise has shared her ideas and her understanding of Chapter 7. And we hope to see you soon for more of same. Thank you and goodbye.